I'm turning now to the book of Job, chapter 40 and verse 1. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, "Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer it." We've been reading through the words of Elihu, God's representative, and God himself, about the creating and sustaining power of God in massive things and in small and microscopic things. And all this has been unfolded to Job of old. And the message of it has been that in all despondency and grief and need, we as believers should look to him, his power and his providential care, and trust him and never break off that trust. Now Job held an exalted position. Satan had challenged God. Nobody believes for nothing. Well, says God, consider my servant Job, somebody who has sought the Lord genuinely and sincerely and is my true servant. No, says Satan, he doesn't serve you for nothing. If we can only have it arranged to take away his well-being and at length his family and so on, his riches, then he will curse God and deny the faith in effect. And so there's the great test. Will Job prove that his conversion to God, his faith, his walk is true? Well, he did prove it. He never denied his God. He held on tightly all the way through. But, as we've repeatedly pointed out, he wasn't without fault. He did repeatedly challenge God. This is unfair. This is all wrong. Why should I be suffering as I am? I've done nothing to deserve this. And he got worked up to the point where he wanted an opportunity to argue it out with God. If God would only appear in some way, if God would speak to him and let him present his case, he'd tell God how unfair he had been. So on the one hand, his faith was proved. He never denied God. He was everything to him. He remained loyal to him. But on the other hand, he said terribly unworthy things about him. And for these now, he's going to be reproved by God, in due course forgiven and wonderfully restored. But in the course of this reproving, we find beasts brought in partly as a means of challenging Job. He says in verse 4, and I shall rush, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay mine hand upon my mouth. Once have I spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no further." But that's not going to be an end of the matter. "Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, Gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me." He's going to be challenged further. His regret and his repentance is too easy. He means it, yes, but he's collapsed quickly, and it's likely to be getting him out of the reproof that he deserves. And God wants him to be truly restored and to face up to what he's done. So these verses continue, "Gird up thy loins now like a man." Verse 8, "Wilt thou also disannul my judgment?" Do you realize what you've done and the significance of this? God has been declared unjust by you. You have taken one of the great attributes of God, bedrock of his character, and made him faulty and defected and unfaithful. He's been wronged by God. This has got to be properly dealt with, seen through. Verse 9, "Hast thou an arm like God? Canst thou thunder with a voice like him? Do you have the power of God or the authority of God? Is the meaning of the poetry. And then here is Job. Remember that he's severely afflicted. He's on the ground. He's covered in sore boils. He's so sick, and his very frame has collapsed under the weight of his illness. And so God says to him in verse 10, deck thyself now with majesty and excellency. If you think you have the attributes and the power and the holiness and the goodness to challenge God, why don't you just get up? Why don't you just assume radiance and excellence and splendor? You can't. Of course you can't. You need the help of God. You can't criticize God, who has ultimate power. And the words from verse 9 on are really along those lines. Look at you, Job. And then I'm coming down to verse 15, and I want to look at these animals. And this is really a first heading. We'll just have two. And Job is going to be convicted by a beast. Now, there are two broad reasons why these beasts are brought into the picture in the words of God. Partly, they are going to reflect the power and invincibility of God. If some of his mere creatures have such strong attributes as these that are going to be described, then what does it say about the vastly superior eminence and power of Almighty God, whom Job has challenged? He believes in him, but he's challenged his fairness and his power to be faithful to his people. So one of the points of bringing up particularly these two creatures that will follow in chapter 40 and 41 is to illustrate the invincibility of God. But that's not all. There's another reason, and it's just as important. It's to put before Job a picture of what can be accomplished by a mere beast. If these characteristics that are going to be described are true of the beasts, and you're a man, Job, you're God's favorite, you're a human being. Everything was created for human beings. They are the pinnacle of God's creative work. They are the ultimate being with a soul to be related to God. And yet here are animals who have qualities which vastly exceed the poor qualities exhibited by Job in his collapse and his charges against God. This is a challenge to Job. Well, how do we know? Well, because the language tells us. For instance, you go on to this verse here in verse 16. Behold now Behemoth, which simply means, straight out of the Hebrew, it means a great creature, a great beast. We have to decide what we think it probably is. Behold now this great creature, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. The word translated behold is an interesting and a strong version of the see or look. It could be translated something like this: look hard. Look hard at Behemoth, the creature who will be described. Don't just look at his superficial characteristics. Look hard. There's a message here. It's not just a biological description, but there is a message. Now, Job may be reacting already. Who knows, as soon as God says this, but this is a creature. This is an animal. I'm a human being. Yes, God seems to say, which I made with thee. Created at creation at approximately the same time. He eateth grass as an ox. He's a mere grass eater. Yet now we're going to look at his powers and strengths and accomplishments, bearing in mind that they not only reflect the far greater power and invincibility of God, but they reflect the ideal for somebody, for a human being, trusting in God and in his goodness and in his power. So we look from verse 16 at the description. Lo now, his strength is in his loins. What is he? Now our King James translators thought he was an elephant. And they thought he was an elephant because of verse 17. He moveth his tail like a cedar. Well, an elephant doesn't do that, but it moves its trunk like a cedar. And so the translators took the view in those days that as the Hebrew for tail only really comes from the verb to wag, to move about, it could be a trunk, it could be a tail. They've translated it tail, but they tended to assume elephant. But the favourite view of this down the centuries, and I think it's undoubtedly the right view, is a hippopotamus. Mark you, verse 17, at first sight doesn't fit the hippo. He moveth his tail like a cedar. Well, if you have in mind a strong cedar trunk, a hippo's tail is nothing whatever like that. So that part doesn't fit and requires some explaining and understanding. The modern alternative among Bible believers, particularly in the light of creationism and young earth, is that this is a dinosaur. And a particular dinosaur is often alighted upon. But it can't be a dinosaur, because although a dinosaur certainly has the tail for this description, a dinosaur doesn't have anything else which fits the description. It's far too big to be hidden by reeds. It cannot stand or even sit under a lotus tree. It's much too big for that. So it's unlikely to be any sort of dinosaur. It's not like a hippo, seemingly capable of drinking a river and utterly happy in the water with a huge mouth which opens wide and seems happy to drink all of Jordan. None of that fits any kind of dinosaur. And it's all very questionable whether there were dinosaurs 4,000 years ago at the time of Job. They were most likely eradicated by the flood that was earlier. So the dinosaur is unlikely, and certainly there were not dinosaurs around throughout most of Bible history, so this illustration wouldn't have had much application until the 1850s at the earliest, where the first bit of dinosaur was discovered in North America. And the other bits to make a whole one didn't appear until later. So it's unlikely to have been what to most of church history would have been a mythological animal. So I think the old writers were probably nearer to the mark when they said hippo. But I cannot explain to you how a hippo's tail can be anything like a cedar. He moveth his tail like a cedar. Mark you, as you probably know, and I won't go into the details, what a hippo does with his tail is quite revolting. And the action and the vigour with which he distributes his excrement in the river with the frantic movements of his powerful little tail could well in some way fit the movement of branches of a cedar tree. Who knows? But I can't really explain the fit of verse 17 very well. But back to verse 16. Lo now, his strength is in his loins. which the meaning of which is obvious. A hippo, its strength is not skin deep. It's not surface behavior, like ours may be. As Christian people, we may be very polite. We may say all the right things to people. We may hold our bearing and deportment and seem to be godly and righteous people until stirred up or insulted or upset or suffering grief or shocked in some way. And then sometimes our behavior proves to be skin deep and our words and reactions. But the hippo, the illustration of the poet, is that his strength goes right into him. His strength of being and character. That's what he's illustrating. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force is in the navel of his belly. It's right deeply set within him. Oh, that it was in us by laying hold on the Lord. And verse 17, if you just move over his tail for the moment, the sinews of his stones or his thighs are wrapped together. That's the more modern translation of stones in our King James Version. So that has to do with his movement, obviously. This creature is so heavy, it may be ponderous, but nothing gets in its way. If it desires to go forward through the swamp or through the river, no amount of debris or broken trees or anything will stop it. It goes forward, unimpeded. Oh, that was like us. Make progress, even in difficult circumstances. Verse 18, his bones are as strong pieces of brass and like bars of iron. Insults, indignities, slanders, dislike. He isn't turned upside down by them. He is a Christian man or woman, and he lay holds on the Lord in prayer. Verse 19, he is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Only God can direct him. And the idea here is that the trusting, earnest Christian shouldn't be able to be deflected by temptation or Satan or the attractions of the world. Only God and God's standards command him and direct him. There is a meaning to each poetic verse. And it becomes quite extraordinary in verse 20. Surely the mountains bring him forth food. But he doesn't go up the mountains. He stays in the river and the swamps. But his food comes from the mountains. How is that done? All the beasts of the field play there. Is he in competition with them? Is he some kind of a predator beast who's going to have to haul himself up the mountains and ward off competition and other beasts? No, the extraordinary thing about the hippo is that the waters running off the mountains will bring every nutrient he needs. All the grass and the sprigs and everything down to where he feeds. He does nothing except trust the natural effects of the surrounding hills and mountains and competes with no one. There's an extraordinary picture there, I think, for the Christian who, obviously, we go to work. Obviously, we have a lot to do to look after ourselves. There's no denial of that. But the Christian person doesn't live in worry and panic and anxiety, trusting God and looking to him and bringing everything in prayer to him. And we resemble in that sense the hippo at the bottom of the mountain. Everything serves him and serves his interest. Verse 21, the same idea is extended further. He lieth under the shady trees, in the covert of the reed and fens, The shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. He's a very comfortable beast. He knows peace and tranquility. And the way the poetry expresses it, it's as though all those trees, reeds, fens, the willows, are there for his benefit. They're actually provided for him. We could study their life cycles biologically, and we wouldn't be right unless somewhere we built into that life cycle the whole purpose of this tree is to feed the hippo and ultimately to supply him. He's the focal point of the poem. He's the center of it all. It's as though God is saying through this to Job, you are the same. You are my delight. You are my child, my son. Everything is for you, for your benefit and your interests. Paul says exactly the same. Everything is for you. Everything flows towards you from the plan and the mind of God. And that's the basis of tranquility. The hippo's got it, and the Christian very often hasn't. Verse 23, behold, he drinketh up a river and hasteth not. I rather think this is because the river is flooded and everyone else is getting out of the way and other beasts are watching from afar. They're delighted, but they want to know where the water settles. But the hippo, he's right in the middle of it, utterly unafraid, no fleeing, no running, no panic. He thinks he could drink the whole river if he has to. He's unafraid. His confidence is so great. Ultimately for us, it's a picture of trust. Verse 24, he taketh it with his eyes. He surveys the river. It doesn't worry him. His nose pierceth through snares. All kinds of snares were cast on the river for fish and creatures, but none of them worried the hippo. They hardly registered with him. And in life, with the protection and the blessing of the Lord, this is the challenge. No things should throw us down into misery, despair, or panic. Then chapter 41, we've got time to at least look at some of it. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook? My heading here, just a second final heading, is no compromise, because the theme of the Leviathan is quite different. The Leviathan, the word simply means a large water animal. It could be anything huge that lives in water. In Psalm 104, the Leviathan is clearly a whale, because it's far out at sea. So it's something like a whale. But here, this Leviathan, from its habitat and its habits and its description, is obviously a river crocodile. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook? Well, will this crocodile, will it let you fish him out with a fish hook and a bit of bait? Is it interested in your fly or worm or anything like that? It's got its eyes on you. If you get too far into the river, it's not going to respond to your little bait. That's the beginning. Of course, ultimately, this pictures the invincibility of God, but it should picture the Christian too. Do we rise to baits? Silly baits that unbelievers may throw in our way to try to upset us or to bring out the worst of us? A crocodile is completely indifferent. You can't deal with him with hooks and baits. Or his tongue. People object the crocodile doesn't have a tongue. It does have a tongue, it's just very small. But the point is, whether it has a prominent tongue or not. This is poetry. Or his tongue. Can you get open into his mouth and make a tiny noose and capture his tongue? Will he keep his jaws open while you do it? Hang a little noose down in. You can't play games like that with a crocodile. You can't bring him down and ensnare him. Verse 2, same thought. Canst thou put a hook into his nose? You don't get near his nose, or play games or meddle with that, or bore his jaw through with a thorn. The idea probably in the original is to prop the jaw open with a thorn. You're wasting your time. You can't tamper with him. He won't compromise with you. He won't fall for silly little tricks. And the true believer is strong against the wiles of the devil. Verse 3, will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words toward thee, unto thee? Inconceivable that the croc will plead for its life. And in verse 4, offer to come and be your servant, if only you'll spare his life, because he's afraid of you. Wilt thou take him for a servant forever? All this is preposterous. You wouldn't dream of it. You wouldn't expect it from a croc. It's got its own lifestyle and its own habits which it follows. It isn't going to be tempted or to compromise. Well, you can see the picture and the challenge. But Job fell. Those friends, so-called, to whom he'd witnessed for years, literary geniuses, men of poetry, he formed a literary circle with them, and they didn't like his testimony, his witness, his words about God, and when he was sick, they pounced on him, and they tried to destroy him with words, and he was unduly aggravated by it, and upset by it, and fell for it. The croc wouldn't have been. Verse 5, wilt thou play with him as with a bird? Or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens, your little daughters? Will you put a lead on him as though he's a little dog and lead him home and give the lead to a little child and say, here is your new puppy, your new... Of course you wouldn't. You can't bring the crocodile to compromise himself for you. Verse 6, shall the companions make a banquet of him? That's probably fellow traders. You've caught him, you've got him, can they? So you have a banquet and then divide the rest among you as traders for sale. He won't let you do that. Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons? Well, this was how they went for whales. Multiple barbs and harpoons and spears, and even a powerful whale could be brought under by simply multiplicity of captors. But that doesn't work with the croc. It's the most unsafe thing to do. Verse 8, lay thine hand upon him, remember the battle no more. You'll find he cannot be captured. Verse 9, behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? Well, speaking for myself, certainly, and I'm sure you'd share that view, crocodile is a frightening thing. You've probably seen a crocodile or alligators, and they send a shiver down your spine. You don't want to go near them. Verse 10, none is so fierce that dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand before me? The invincibility of God. And yes, behold, the crocodile, made at the same time as you, Job, a mere grass eater. It's an invitation for the crocodile to be compared with Job himself. And I pass down, really, verse 12 I will not conceal his parts, nor his power, nor his comely proportion. Who can discover the face of his garment? Which probably means, will he let you skin him? Not a very nice thought, but of course he won't. Who can come to him with his double bridle, his great jaws? Who can open the doors of his face? Same thought in poetry. His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride, shut up together as with a close seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together that they cannot be sundered. Of course, people can find all sorts of flaws in us. They can observe our weak points. The idea is, Job, the crocodile doesn't exhibit any weak points. You look at its top and its back, and you can't figure out where to get your spear. Yet, for us, it's so easy for the unbeliever to find cause, to find fault. And we could go through these, but our time now is virtually up. Verse 18, by his sneezings, if you like, a light doth shine. Not literally, it's poetry. But when a crocodile comes up from the deep and exhales furiously, the steam and the air glistens in the light. It's a very impressive sight, is the idea of the poetry, like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, same thought, not literal fire. He's not a dragon, but that's the impression, something in the poem very impressive and not a little frightening. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or cauldron. That's the description of the crocodile. And in our words, if you like, and in our speech, in our conversation, doesn't mean it's furious, but it means it's sound and good, and there's testimony there, and sense there, and we're observed for it. In his neck remaineth strength, verse 22, sorrow is turned into joy before him. And the description goes on. Verse 24, his heart firm as a stone. Verse 25, when he raiseth up himself, the mighty are afraid. And verse 26, the sword of him that layeth at him cannot hold. In fact, he esteems weapons, verse 27, as straw and brass as rotten wood. Verse 28, he's not afraid. And he counts all the weapons that are brought to him as nothing. I'll end with verse 31. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh a path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary. Isn't that magnificent? Where the croc has been active, you know a crocodile has been there. What a wonderful thing if it could be said, where that Christian has been, you can tell. In his wake and behind him, he leaves a reputation. He leaves people who appreciated his integrity. He leaves a testimony. He may, in the goodness of God, leave converts. He leaves a history in his wake where the croc has been. Well, you can see that he's been there. And that's the idea. Upon earth, there is Lot his like. And so the crocodile teaches the invincibility of God and teaches also a model for the behavior of the Christian. Job, convicted by a couple of beasts, and so are we. Job, totally humbled and shown the goal for trust in God.